from the heart of our nation's capital, this is Washington Watch Weekend Edition. Now, here's your host, David Salkeld.
Hello, welcome to the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm Russ Jones, giving weekend host and producer David Salkeld a well-deserved break. I produce and guest host the show throughout the week. During the National Day of Prayer commemoration at the White House last week, you might have taken note of the two gentlemen President Trump invited to the platform in the Rose Garden, John Ponder and Richard Beasley. They have a compelling story behind the relationship to one another. John, a former bank robber, and Richard, the special agent that put John behind bars. We'll hear their compelling story they shared with Tony. Commissioner Daniel Mark, chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, told us earlier in the week about the commission's latest report on religious freedom. All of this great content can be found on TonyPerkins.com, and you can also follow Tony on Twitter at TPerkins. Well, last week on the National Day of Prayer, President Trump announced an executive order that will expand government grants to and partnerships with faith-based groups. During the commemoration in the Rose Garden, John Ponder, a former convicted bank robber and who founded Hope for Prisoners after leaving prison, and retired supervisory special agent with the FBI, who put John behind bars, Richard Beasley. The two talked with Washington Watch host and FRC President Tony Perkins earlier this week.
Joining us now is John Ponder and Richard Beasley. John and Richard, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you, Tony.
John, I want to start with you. You grew up, your mother did the best job she could. You were in a single-parent home. You said you got into gangs, into trouble, and ultimately ended up robbing a bank. Talk a little bit about that, about growing up and your desire. What drew you to the gangs? What drew you to crime?
I think at a very early age, you know, again, dad wasn't there. My story is probably like millions of people across America growing up in a single-parent home, you know, the streets, looking towards the street to validate masculinity. And that's where the streets kind of gave me an identity. That led me to the drugs. Drugs led me to the gangs. Gangs led me to, you know, criminal activity, which led me to my very first set of handcuffs at a very early age.
How long did you spend in prison for bank robbery?
Well, on that particular charge, it was just a little over 6 years. 6 years for bank robbery. But Tony, I think it's important to know that that wasn't the, you know, my very first stint. I had been getting in trouble in and out of different jails and prisons and on various charges. But that last time was truly the last time.
Did that get your attention?
Oh, very, very much so. But I think there was several other things that had come into place that really got my attention. I believe that what got my attention this last time, what made a difference from all the other time, is that, you know, God had really grabbed a hold of my heart. I had found myself in a situation saying, looking back over the course of my life, saying that, you know, I know that it has to be more to life than the past 38 years that I was living up to that one point. And I had this unshakable sense that somehow something could be better if somehow something was different. And I think that difference was, you know, making Jesus the Lord of my life.
Richard Beasley, you're a retired FBI agent. You made the arrest. You put John behind bars. But something prompted you to pray for him. And tell us about that.
Well, all the guys that I'd come into contact with, either as witnesses or subjects as John was, they all had different stories in their life, and some were more open to prayer than others. John just was, when I first met him, was just kind of lost. He was angry. He was confused. He was upset. And, you know, we had a fairly lengthy drive back from the jail that he was in to take him to federal court. I got to know him a little bit. And as guys would come in and out of my life, out of my work life, I would occasionally say prayers for them, and John just seemed a perfect candidate for some prayers at that time.
And when John was released from prison, the president last week saying that one of the first knocks at his door was you. You went to see him and pray for him.
Well, before John had gotten out, he called me. He called me a couple times from prison. his mom was worried about him at one point, so I gave her a call, and there was probably one or two other things that he called me about. But before he got out, he had a couple of things that just needed a little help with for them to secure his release to the halfway house, so I helped him out with that. So after he got out, we ended up meeting at a McDonald's, and you know, he showed up, and he had a Bible. And I'd seen that before where guys want to use the Bible as a prop. Mm-hmm. But this was not a prop to John at that time.
John, let me ask you this. What influence did that outreach by Richard, his willingness to pray for you, to see you as something more than just, you know, a criminal, what impact did that have on you?
You know, that had a major, major impact, Tony, that rippled into who I am today. So prior to that, while I was in prison, I had my unmistakable road to Damascus, where I had surrendered my life to the Lord. And every waking moment of my time inside the penitentiary, I just spent that time just cultivating my relationship with Jesus Christ. So when I had come home and I am on fire for the Lord, when I crossed path once again with Rich Beasy there, and he indicated to me that he was praying, he had prayed for me. Just then, Tony, I was overwhelmed with the sense that God was in complete control of it all from day one, even to the point to where, you know, Richard Beasy was there in that first interaction with him. And I share with folks that I believe that God used FBI agent Richie Beasley to snatch me up out of the kingdom of darkness and to convey me into the kingdom of the Son of His love.
John, since the transformation of your life, you started back in, I believe, 2009, Hope for Prisoners. It's a 501c3 nonprofit organization that facilitates reentry and reintegration services to men, women, and young adults who are exiting various segments of the judicial system. And what you say is this is a holistic approach to encourage and impart hope into ex-offenders as you come alongside them and their families in an effort to transform lives and systematically educate society in ways to engage and support them. What kind of success rates have you seen with this?
You know, yeah, it has been absolutely phenomenal, and we give all credit to God. One of the statistics that I'd like to share with you, in a partnership with the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, they had come in and they had taken a look at 522 randomly of the almost 2,000 folks, a little over 2,000 that we have worked with. And what UNLV's Criminal Justice Department had determined that of those 522 individuals, nearly 70% of those were successful in gaining full-time employment. 25% of those were full-time employed in meaningful employment within 17 days of graduation. And of those 522 individuals, they determined that only 6% of those individuals returned back to the system. We attribute 100% of that to prayer. We considered to attribute that to the training given individuals who are returning from the prison system, the necessary tools and the know-how in order for them to be successful. We have a mentoring component that is unmatched and unparalleled in the country, to where we've trained up over 300 men and women from our community that serve as mentors. Now, these are pastors and leaders from churches across Southern Nevada. These are some of the top business owners here in our state that God has brought alongside our team. School teachers from the school district, because we put a strong emphasis on education, right down to the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, to where our police department has given us nearly 60, a small army of volunteer police officers that serve as mentors and trainers to the men and women returning to our community.
Wow, that's
and
phenomenal.
It is evidence of how big the God is that we serve, Tony, because never before in the history of reentry, nowhere on this planet to this magnitude, has law enforcement gotten us involved in mentoring and training folks that are coming out of the prison system underneath the leadership of our undersheriff, Kevin McMahill, who made a statement that we cannot arrest the way out of the problems here in our community.
Yeah.
And this is why law enforcement has gotten this engaged in our mechanism. So
those are some amazing numbers. And I was in law enforcement, began my career working in the prisons. And so I've seen this up firsthand and understand the impact of this. Did you ever see yourself doing something like this, John?
You know, if you asked me many, many, many years ago before my surrender of my life to the Lord, absolutely, positively not. But when I was in prison trying to learn and understand things like, you know, why did I do all the crazy stuff that I did? I wanted to understand, why do people do what people do? So I dug in deep into the pages of my Bible and began to learn all these different things about me. And it came a point on that journey where I felt like God was saying to me is that he's teaching me things that I could turn right back around and help some other people that were once in bondage to the same exact thing that I was in bondage to.
Let me ask you, this is a 501c ministry. How are you bankrolling this ministry?
You know, it's funny you say that because early on, everything that we did came off of personal and private donations. We were brand new. We, you know, couldn't, you know, no history or any grants or anything of that nature. So for the first 5 years, everything was coming off of personal and private donations. And when we were able to build up the statistics and show that we had gotten great at what it was that we were doing, you know, we were awarded a Department of Labor grant that we're still in the process of working through.
Richard, I want to bring you back into this. As I mentioned, I spent almost 10 years in law enforcement myself, local law enforcement. I understand the complexities, the difficulties of those jobs. But I want to ask you, because this, you made a comment that you said, you know, you often would pray with men. You had a long drive. I remember those days myself. Talk about how you were able to integrate your faith, how your faith actually influenced your role as an FBI agent.
Well, there were many days when I asked God to guide me and lead me in everything that I did, and especially when we were getting ready to go to do an important interview or getting ready to do a high-risk arrest or a search warrant or a car stop or something like that. And then I also asked him to keep us all safe and help us all to use good judgment, because that's very important. But it just, you know, I never really wore my faith on my sleeve. But at certain points in times, I felt like it needed to be shared, and did so as he kind of guided me.
And wouldn't you define that as religious freedom, the ability to allow your faith to influence your life?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I think guys in law enforcement, as you know, they need to a higher guidance than just what the regulations are, what the badge on their chest says. And having God in your life is something that you can hang on to.
Well, that was Tony Perkins talking with John Ponder and Richard Beasley. Coming up next, Daniel Mark, chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, with an update on religious freedom violations and progress happening around the world.
Every day, Christian values are increasingly being pushed out of public policy. What can ordinary Christians do to make their voices heard in their day-to-day lives and in Washington, D.C.? We want to hear from you. Send us a question you may have about how you can better live out your faith beyond the four walls of your church. Go to frc.org/askfrc and enter Ask FRC in the subject line for a chance to be published on our blog. Thank you for standing with us.
Welcome back to the Weekend Edition with Tony Perkins. I'm Russ Jones, sitting in for weekend host David Saukel. Well, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom has released its 2018 annual report documenting religious freedom violations and progress in 28 countries during calendar year 2017 and making recommendations to the U.S. government. Here's Tony Perkins as he talked with Daniel Mark, chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom.
And joining me now is the chairman of the Commission on International Religious Freedom, Daniel Mark. Daniel, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much for having me on. Great to be here.
Well, Daniel, in your report that, again, was officially released yesterday, you say that although no administration in the 20-year existence of the International Religious Freedom Act has implemented the law to its fullest potential, you see some very promising things happening on the international front when it comes to religious freedom.
That's absolutely right. And that's both at home and abroad. So at home, we have, as we did at the end of the last administration, a great new ambassador at large for international religious freedom. We've got a new national security advisor in John Bolton, who actually served a term in the early days on the commission. And we hope that he will be, he will help the president be the, make them the first administration to have, as the legislation says, a religious freedom advisor on the National Security Council. We've got a vice president who's deeply invested in this issue. His heart's really in it, and he's been a great help on a large number of issues. And then abroad, we're seeing a proliferation, I don't know why I got stuck on that, proliferation of organizations that are dedicated to this, both government ministries, other ambassadors at large, and the UN, the EU, and international networks that are bringing people together all across the world in support of religious freedom.
Now, Chairman, I've been following the work for the commission of the commission for, I guess, about 15 years since I've been on the national scene. And, you know, historically, it looks like the commission's done a really good job of tracking the abuses, identifying the problems. But it appears to me from reading your report and the previous report that the commission is now moving into a new phase of maturity to where it's not just identifying problems, but is aggressively pursuing solutions.
That's right. Legislation does mandate us to provide recommendations, just like you said, each year. And we're doing that. But we're really, as you said, at a new stage of trying to think creatively and carefully about what kind of recommendations are really possible, that we can actually get them implemented and that are really going to have an impact, that are going to make a difference. We've been focusing a lot, for example, on the targeted tools like the Global Magnitsky Act, which allows our government to sanction not just countries, but individuals and organizations that are responsible for persecuting people, that can freeze their assets or deny them visas. And this is something that we're starting to use in our government on other issues as well. But it's important that officials responsible for, you know, jailing people, torturing people, killing people because of, you know, religious discrimination, that those people are not allowed to benefit from the banking system or just to come to the United States for their Christmas shopping.
Right. But Chairman Mark, you've also brought greater attention through, I mean, I know part of your task is to make recommendations, track, identify, report, make recommendations, but you've taken some initiative, which I applaud you for, with the Religious Prisoners of Conscience Project, where you're identifying these people like Pastor Brunson, Andrew Brunson in Turkey, putting a face to this, and the commissioners are taking on these individuals and working not only for their release, but to bring greater awareness to this global problem.
Yes, gosh, it's something so important, and I'm sure your listeners are all too familiar with the very sad and unjust case of Pastor Brunson's imprisonment in Turkey. What we've done, we've always been trying to keep as big lists as we can of religious prisoners of conscience in the countries that we cover. But what we started to do on a bigger level more recently is having each commissioner adopt a prisoner, and where possible, having members of Congress co-adopt with us so that we can raise their cases. And sometimes this actually helps them get freed. I don't want to exaggerate, but sometimes they get let out earlier than they might otherwise. In some cases, we know that their conditions improve when they are. This is, you know, goes back to the days of the Soviet Union. You know, prisoners who got out of the Soviet Union told us that, you know, every time their name was mentioned publicly, their food got a little better, their conditions got a little better, not to be discounted either is just the morale boost, the psychological factor of knowing that they're not forgotten, they're not abandoned, and that the world is fighting for them. And last but not least, it allows us to highlight the very unjust policies that landed these people in prison in the first place. For example, I've adopted Abdul Shakur, an elderly bookseller in Pakistan. He's an Ahmadi, which is a sect of Islam that's not liked by any of the other Muslims. And he's guilty of nothing that should be a crime, you know, like the blasphemy and apostasy laws in Pakistan. And by shining a light on his case, by holding up his face, we're really able to highlight the injustice of those laws.
Let me just ask you this. First off, I think that's an important point you just made, that this is about religious freedom. as articulated in the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That is the freedom to choose a religion, not to choose a religion, but it's a choice that individuals make, and that's what we advocate for, not a particular type of religion, but the freedom to do that. And where societies have that, there's greater stability, and so that's to the benefit of the United States. So this is not just about promoting one religion or America's majority religion. This is about promoting religious freedom.
Absolutely.
Have you seen in this administration, I know your tenure as chairman is coming to an end, but you know, I have great hope with Sam Brownback as the ambassador at large, Mike Pompeo as new Secretary of State. Do you sense that this administration is going to listen more to the recommendations of the commission?
We think so. We hope so. I mean, right, it was very encouraging, for example, that in the national security strategy released, if I'm not mistaken, in December, that religious freedom was highlighted as a national security priority, not just a human rights priority, but the idea that they get just to what you said a moment ago, that it's not just a matter of doing it because it's American values, which of course it is, to support religious freedom, and it should be a universal value. You mentioned the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but also that it's deeply in our interest because countries, like you said, that have religious freedom are more stable, they're more prosperous, they're more peaceful, and this administration seems to get that. This administration also seems to be very willing to look the problems squarely in the eye, to call them by their name. You remember, I'm sure, in the later years of the Obama administration, the big fight over whether to call the actions of ISIS a genocide. And we finally got it after a lot of fighting. Well, people don't know as much that in the early days of the Trump administration, not because of the president or the vice president, quite the contrary, but because of factions within the State Department or something that was going on, they stopped using the genocide word again. And we came back and said, wait, we already had this fight. And because the president and vice president had been so clear and outspoken on this, we were able to get that fixed again.
I remember that.
It really just shows, it shows a real commitment on their part. And, you know, that's where it has to start, too. You know, if you don't look the problem squarely in the face and call it by its name, and obviously it goes without saying that our current president has shown a great willingness to stand up to dictators. You know, we've seen it now, Syria, North Korea, Iran. And so that's very encouraging for those who are in this struggle with us.
Chairman, I see in the recommendations to the administration, the two top recommendations, you mentioned one of them just a moment ago, but the first is to ensure that the ambassador at large has the necessary authority and resources to carry out the mandates of the law, including sufficient funding and staffing for the office. And then secondly, and similarly, is to appoint promptly a qualified and experienced individual to be special advisor to the president on international religious freedom within the National Security Council.
Mm-hmm.
These personnel are policy. You know that in Washington, D.C. That's what drives these things. Do you foresee, and I think this is significant, for 20 years it hasn't been there, but it's been in the law, to have a special advisor a part of the National Security Council focused on religious freedom. Do you think that may happen?
I think we've got our best shot yet. Like I said, you know, it helps that John Bolton is the new National Security Advisor. When he got that, the man you mentioned before, Frank Wolf, co-authored an op-ed that went around Washington that this might be, you know, the most pro-religious liberty national security advisor we've ever had. Not, I mean, the others support it, of course, but one who really gets the role that it plays here. So I think there's a real shot. Now, of course, there are lots of political reasons why no president, Republican or Democrat, has done it in these 20 years, and so I don't think it's necessarily going to be a light lift to get it done.
Wait, let me say, what are the political reasons not to do it?
Probably the same reasons that the International Religious Freedom Act was passed and USURF, our commission, exists in the first place, and that's that, you know, out there in our foreign policy bureaucracy and the State Department and all the other competing interests, Treasury and defense, so there's a lot of priorities, and And everybody wants their issue to be first, and that's understandable. We've got huge economic issues, say, with China, or military issues and so on. But we believe that for both, like I said before, both reasons of values and our interests, religious freedom needs to be a higher priority. That's why Congress created us. They said, we need a group that's going to make sure religious freedom is elevated as a priority. And to put someone, you know, on a special advisor to the president on this means to throw one more competing priority into the mix. It's the same reason why every year the State Department declines to take us up on some of our recommendations for CPC designations for countries of particular concern, because we say, look at Pakistan, how could you not designate them? And other people say, well, look, it's a sensitive relationship, and, you know, they cooperate with us in Afghanistan and so on, and so to the extent that they do, so let's not poke the bear kind of thing. And that's tough. But again, this administration has really been showing itself to understand this and to be willing to make moves that others aren't. And so we hope that something like that will happen.
Well, Daniel, you also have, though, after 20 years, there's a lot of academic research out there that validates the point that you've made, that where religious freedom is allowed, there's greater stability. So it's not just another element. It is a very important element for all of the other aspects of national security that we're pursuing.
Absolutely right. And, you know, we in the West have believed for a long time that, for example, you got to start with democracy building and then you get human rights and religious freedom. And that theory has been, it's a good theory, but it's kind of been falling apart lately with what's happened in Burma. Let's say, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi got in power. There's been a democratic process, but it's been very disappointing on human rights. Now, partly that's because the military is still there. The big story on China, you know, for all the economic
right.
opening up that
right.
they've had, it's only gotten more authoritarian. And so maybe this story is the other way. Maybe we start with human rights
right.
and especially religious freedom, and then we see democracy following. And I think religious freedom is really the bedrock, the first freedom that underpins the whole idea of human rights. And I'd love to talk more about that when there's time. But in any case, I really think that that might be the way to look at these things. And like you said, there is research now supporting the correlations between religious freedom and all these positive social indicators. And so hopefully that's something our government will understand. And just like you said, say, well, it's not just that national security or religious freedom. It's that they're tied together. We can't have one without the other.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed this weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. If you've not heard us throughout the week, you can hear us on about 250 stations across the country and online at tonyperkins.com from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm Russ Jones, in for David Salkeld, weekend host and producer. If the waters don't rise and the Lord tarries, we'll see you next weekend.
Washington Watch Weekend Edition is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit tonyperkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.